Yes, I do know the answer.
Oh, here we go.
And
Oh, this is easy. Oh, we'll clap it off here. No worries.
I could say it's 42, but Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The answer is, and it's exactly what you were saying about this podcast, and some people really enjoy it, some people sort of don't. And I think of, I don't listen to that many podcasts, but the podcasts I've listened to are the podcasts where there are no answers, and where there's actually people who are sort of talking about what it and what's going on. And I think that's about the philosophy of life. It's people having conversations that don't come to the answers, but the answers are informing the people listening to this now. They're forming answers in their heads as we speak, because they're either agreeing with you on what you're saying or disagreeing with you on what you're sort of saying. But they're starting to have a conversation, whether it's with themselves, they're having conversation with us, maybe they have conversations with each other. So the answers are not there. But the answers need to emerge over time, and they will take a long time, but we've got to start somewhere. We're just about to go into the voice referendum, giving a voice to Aboriginal people, and I just feel what is so incredibly important about that is that it's not the answer. The voice is not going to solve the problems. It's not going to solve. I'm not sure whether it will solve immediately any of the problems, but it is start of something that might lead to generational shift. It might the next generation of people growing up might feel different about the country in which they live and the relationship with other people, and the people after that might feel different. And I think that we will start to see the benefit of the decision we make in a few months' time will be felt in 50, 100 years' time. But that's not a reason not to start it. And I know there's an argument, and I strongly support that what the world needs today is not more politicians or economists or policemen, but it's actually more philosophers. People need to be able to pose the questions that policymakers need to work on finding real answers to. So that to me is the value of this conversation.
And to, I guess, go on to the back of that, I guess, unfortunately, the world currently, whether that changes moving forward, who knows, but the world works in sound bites these days, and those sound bites are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and politicians rely on it, business people rely on it, marketing people, whoever that might be. And so it's that you have a question, here's my answer, kind of idea. And again, the kind of policies that are made, and they're all about, I need to be re-elected in 3 years' time. So the decisions I'm making and the policies I'm putting forward are so that in 3 years' time, you remember that I made that policy. So it gets me re-elected to stay in this system again for another 3 years. And the idea of kind of setting up some sort of system that, hey guys, I need everyone to kind of help me out here, because it's not going to be me who's going to be here, but in 20 years' time, 50 years' time, the decisions we're making here will make a huge impact on those lives of those. We all then internalize that and go, fuck the people 50 years from now. How are you helping me now? Kind of mindset.
So
So
my answer to
how do we
that
steer that forwards?
is very simple. Whether you live in Melbourne, whether you live in Sydney, whether you live in New York, London, Paris, take any great city around the world, any great town, any village, the part of that place that people love more than anywhere else is the botanical gardens, the municipal gardens. Our gardens here in Melbourne are just the most beautiful place on earth. And to think that, oh, what are we talking about? 200 years ago, 150, 180 years ago, when Melbourne was a swampy land, that people put aside this area of land, and it was, and you know it, you know the botanical gardens here. It's the best piece of land, not least of which because it's on top of a hill. So it is the place that's least likely to get swamped. Coincidence, no coincidence that the two best private schools in Melbourne are on the border of the botanical gardens and things. It was those people 180 years ago, wherever, said, you know what? We're going to do something that's not going to, we're not going to enjoy in our lifetime. Our children are not even going to enjoy in their lifetime, but maybe their children will start to get some enjoyment out of it. And it is still there and it's still real. I feel very strongly, maybe I said this on the last podcast, we have just come out of a global pandemic, you know, the most extraordinary event that sort of happened since dropping of bombs and world wars to us. And I feel that we need to all in some way recognize that, recognize in a way that shows future generations we came through this. So whatever they face in their lifetimes, they'll be able to look back on us and say, look at them, you know, they went through this and they actually came through this united, better, stronger, and they laid down this foundation, this something or other that they laid down, you know, in 2022, 2023, that we're all now able to sort of appreciate. And I don't know what that is. It, maybe that is the voice. Maybe it is, maybe the voice is something which is symbolic more of than just our reconciliation with the indigenous people of this country. It's more about our reconciliation with each other and those people who haven't had all the advantages of going to the best private schools in Melbourne, haven't had all the advantages of being born into a family where, you know, as I know, you spend a lot of time with your girls reading and being with them and activities and so on. So maybe this is maybe that's what the voice is. Maybe we should look at it as a bigger thing and say it's our start. From today onwards, we're going to have different conversations with each other.
Let me be a cynic for a moment and please show me evidence or tell me otherwise to kind of steer my thoughts in a different direction. But the way I've seen us come out of this pandemic, I see we've just flipped the switch straight away. Like I'm with you in that I believe that this was a time where we genuinely could have, in quote, come together as a nation and as a world and use it as like, this is an in quote common enemy that we're all fighting. We all need to kind of, you know, get together and support each other. And let's take more of a preventative approach to things rather than a curative in that what can we do now, as you said, that will benefit generations to come in the way that we dealt with this, the way that we move forward from this, the policies we put in place, the actions we took and whatnot. And I think there was a sense of that in the very beginning. But as time kind of dragged on and it kind of, I think we became more tribal about it because there was definitely two very distinct views of this is the way we should have done it. No, this is the way we should be doing it kind of idea. And then they just butt heads very loudly in the open that life just seems to me anyway. And again, please feel correct me if I am wrong in how you've seen it, but it seems like it's as if the last 3 years didn't happen. Like, I don't know, again, how it goes in Victoria, but where we are in Perth, it's as if COVID just never happened. It's like, let's just get back on the merry-go-round. That was 2 years that we'll just block out of our minds as if that part of the life just didn't exist. It's pre-COVID and now post-COVID. Let's just move on and kind of get... And it just seems like everyone's back on the same merry-go-round. They're doing the same things, like the whole kind of banking system and economics around the world. And it just seems like, I've seen all this before and we're doing the exact same things before. And again, I just play the cynic role in that, you know what? I can't be bothered with it anymore. I'm just going to live in my own little bubble and just spend my life with my girls and do my thing. And the world can just do what it wants to do because I'm sick and tired of trying to fix, help, suggest or whatnot, because what's the point? In, again, I'm playing the cynic in that moment. I don't think about that all the time, but there is this part of me just like, what's the point? Everyone's just going to do the exact same thing they've always done. And whether we have conversations or not, is there really going to be a massive change occur to a societal and a generational kind of level?
Look, I think it's too early to answer that because I think we are still in that sort of, you use the word tribal, soundbite stage of the post-pandemic, and that... I think the irrefutable fact is there was a moment there that we were all scared. Globally, everybody was scared. And I think we've slightly forgotten that, and we've forgotten that in the response and whether this was right or whether that was right. I believe fundamentally that everybody from politicians to policemen to drug companies were acting, trying to work and do the best they possibly could with an impossible situation. And some of those things turned out great, some of them didn't turn out so great. But so saying, I don't think the narrative on the pandemic has yet been written. And you know, I will draw, and maybe it's sort of drawing a long bow to sort of bring in the analogy of the Vietnam War. You know, it took, I forget what it is, you know, 10, 15 years after the end of the Vietnam War for the first movie to come out, you know, Full Metal Jacket or whatever it was, or you know, Apocalypse Now's and so on, because people didn't know how to talk about it. America had, inverted commas, lost that war. There'd been, you know, so much grief, pain, and suffering as a result of it, both in America and other parts of the world. Nobody knew how to tell that story. Nobody knew how to sort of, you know, draw a line on and start to tell. And as you can sort of see, you know, the every single movie I think that's come out about the Vietnam War has been, you know, none of them have glorified the concept of the war. None of them have. You know, all of them have actually sort of, you know, seen it for what it was and how dreadful it was. And so maybe, you know, I've read a couple of books which were written by authors during the pandemic and reference, and the pandemic is part of the backdrop, but they're not necessarily about the pandemic yet. And I think it's once we start to get the sort of, you know, the plays and the dramas, you know, whether, you know, when there's the West Wing type of sort of, once we even start to sort of bring comedy into it as well, and start to really sort of see and start examining it, you know, then we will start to sort of maybe have an understanding of what it meant and what it should mean. So I can understand your cynicism, but I think it's perhaps too early to really say that we have totally drawn a line underneath that for good.
Jump forward then 20 years. Your daughters have had their first children, and they're sitting down and go, hey, Papa, like, Mum tells me about this time we went in, you know, this pandemic thing. Like, what was it like? How would you describe, if you can kind of try and put yourself in a situation 20 years from now, rather than kind of referencing it at this point, like, how do you reckon you tell that story that then maybe we commonly have a similar kind of story that we all kind of tell? How do you reckon you tell that story?
Well, look, at the moment, I think, you know, there's almost every now and then I sort of get a sort of a sense of sort of, you know, I don't, you know, I shouldn't sort of say it, but because it sort of belittles it, but it's a, you know, post-traumatic stress from it, you know, just thinking how bloody awful it was. You know, my friend Gabrielle and I, we would go for our walks in the morning, and the fact that, and we still go to this day, you know, every day we go for our walks and in the morning, the fact that we actually weren't allowed to do that because she wasn't from my household. And, you know, that gives me the heebie-jeebies. There was once a time that what we were doing was deemed to be against the law, you know, the most simple thing. And, you know, that terrifies me, not particularly because of the heavy-handedness of the law, but because, as I said, that sort of extraordinary response, we don't know what's going on here, so we're just going to sort of shut down every single lever that we possibly can until we work it out. So I think, you know, when I think about it now, I do think it was ghastly. And what I've done is I've got a shoebox, and I've got things in the shoebox that are, you know, mementos of, you know, to do my permit, you know, in the car to show that I was doing a sort of essential, in a business, and that permit was right. That wasn't just an open-ended permit. You know, it had to specify the days and the times that, you know, the permit was issued for. You know, so I've got the permit. You know, I've got sort of the masks, vaccination certificates, photographs of, my beach gym with, you know. The yellow tape around it and the signs saying, you know, closed. And, you know, I've got, you know, all those sort of things in a box, because, you know, and hopefully maybe that will help me tell the story one day. I don't know, you know, the story at the moment is largely being told by the politicians and largely being told by the conspiracy theorists and so on. You know, the story, the rights to the story, I think, will be owned by those children who were in their sort of 15, 16, 17, 18s at the time, who really had the rite of passage denied them. You know, we know, you know, and you know, the son of a friend of ours who, you know as well, who he lost those, he never acquired those sort of what I call the sort of the dating, socializing, training wheels. You know, sort of, you know, the going over to a mate's house at 15 and the mate's got an older sister with, you know, one of her friends around and sort of going, wow, there's girls in the same room as me, to the sort of the first sort of parties where you might have had your first kiss and things, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he's now supposed to be supposedly, you know, an adult. And, you know, those things have never happened for him. And I think it will be their story that will be the one that we really, you know, it's not the Trump, the Fauci, the Dan Andrews, the, you know, it's not those stories. You know, those were just the people to trying to sort of put the policy into place. I think it's the story of the people who really, I don't know if you can sort of say lost those years of their life, but certainly those years of their lives were very, very different than how they were for us, and what that does, and how that happens, and how they approach the future, how they, once they get into power, once they get into making policy, once they become the philosophers, the artists, the dramatists, and so on, you know, what stories are they going to be telling? And I think that will be the time, perhaps, when we will be able to then sort of look at the legacy, you know, both, you know, the legacy going back and the legacy going sort of forward of that.
Yeah, I wonder who the director will be of the first movie. Whether, you know, is it a Spielberg, a Ridley Scott, kind of these doomsday kind of movies or whatnot, or is it the kind of heartfelt kind of one where it's, you know, we all made it through and it's a good kind of fairy ending, you know, not the comet hitting the planet and disintegrating everything and we go into this dystopian weird world post pandemic kind of things. So it'll be interesting to see.
I worry, because I know you watch all those sort of movies anyway, and I worry that there's actually nobody left to make anything other than that these days, because the budgets are all being coming from the Netflix and the Amazons and things, and so the there's not necessarily, unless actually it will come out of France, because I think they're the one place in the world that still invests in narrative cinema, and so they're probably the one place that's most likely to actually sort of start using that medium to start having that sort of debate with itself, you know, as in, I don't know, there's a movie coming out right now about the Bataclan terrorist attack, you know, on the nightclub in Paris a few years back. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a movie, you know, coming out now that's got, you know, extraordinary sort of reviews. Because France is capable, I think, of sort of leaning in and telling stories about that sort of stuff. I don't think Hollywood, you know, is there or ready or whatever to do it.
So back on everything we've just kind of said from, I guess that went off on a very different kind of journey from to kind of parry back on the fact that we're talking about a Camino trail, and that's been a bit of a hike and journey we've had on the conversation itself. Is the idea for yourself then, you know, I only just recently talking on again on the last podcast about kind of the minimalist life and kind of not wanting for more or having more and, you know, kind of wanting to share our wealth. And by wealth, I mean our knowledge and what we've acquired over a life with regards to how we can help others. Is it a sense that you sell everything and pack it all up and kind of go and live that kind of nomadic life now that, well, I think you've got a daughter who's soon to be finishing school. Like when school's, you know, and you're basically just you and your wife are kind of grey nomads. Do you guys go, okay, we sell it all up and we kind of go and live this life where we go and help and pilgrimage and do all these other things? Or like, how does life then look moving forward for yourself because of the things that have happened that we've just recently talked about, but also because of the Camino Trail and things that have helped you change there?
I don't know the answer to that. And I think all I can say is the first stage of it is removing envy. And I think, as you know, I love my snowboarding, and you know, I just felt envy for people who would go off to Whistler and sort of spend 3 weeks, 4 weeks in Whistler. I want to remove that envy. Whether or not we downsize and those sort of things, I'm not sure whether or not I'd love to say to you, yes, I am now conscious of the fact, you know, I love reading and I love books, and, you know, I read, you know, one or two books a week, and I look at my library and I've got a whole wall of books there, and I just wonder how long it will take for my girls to get the skip outside and start filling it up with my books after I've died. And so I wonder, I love my Kindle, I'm actually one of the few people who reads a book on the Kindle and then goes out and buys, you know, the hard copy. I love secondhand bookstores for that sort of reason. I don't know. I've got a sort of, maybe come back and ask me in a few years' time. The one thing with our generation is that we're the first generation that, with all good probability, cannot say when it's going to die. Previous generations, actuarial tables have told you that you live three score and ten. You know, with the enormous sort of advances made in science and medication, with general sort of health and things, you know, looking at how many more people each year, the exponential numbers living into their 90s and into their hundreds. And I think the effect that has upon us is that previous generations would have accumulated their wealth and at 65 retired and be told that, well, you know, if you spend at this rate, you know, you will have used it all up in 25 years' time. And that seemed to be quite reasonable. I think the trouble that we have now is being unsure. We're reluctant to actually spend our capital. We want to live off our capital and perhaps to sort of accumulate capital. So these things that I have around me seem to be very comfortable, because they give me confidence that I will be able to, as long as I don't turn into an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever, that I'll be able to have a comfortable future. So I don't know. I've sort of seen people in the past. We used to travel to Spain and go to some of those places in southern Spain where the Brits would sort of take their redundancy money and go and buy a little place in some Spain. And one day, sort of sitting in a cafe, and there's a couple walking along the street, and suddenly he starts clutching his heart and sort of falls down on the floor. And I sort of thought, well, that's where the dream dies. You know, you've lived the last sort of 15, 20 years in this idyllic Mediterranean sort of coast. And all of a sudden, you're now faced with, you know, the loss of one or other partner or long-term illness, and you actually haven't got a community of friends and people around you. Whereas, you know, I don't know how many people listening to this are on first name terms with their pharmacist, you know, with first name terms with you know, the grocer, and the first name terms with the post office. You know, we've got that community. We sort of know each other, and we take pride in that. And so I don't think I think I would always want to sort of come back here. I think there's things that I still want to do, you know, every year, to quote sort of Lululemon, I want to do something that scares me. But no, it's not that sort of change that I'm sort of, I don't think I'm after. It's just more about being just feeling happier, more comfortable, enjoying what I have got already, and finding more people who want to share that enjoyment. And I want to share that enjoyment.
Do you think, I mean, again, it's not to try and pinpoint an answer and say, we have the answers kind of thing, but from what you've kind of been saying there, and what I try and share, I guess, with so many people that listen to the stuff I do and the stuff I produce and whatnot is the key to happiness then is for not wanting more or kind of having envy in your life. Is that why envy was the first thing you mentioned there? And then now you finish the conversation by you wanting to live a happier life. Did it start with, I think I'll be happier if I remove envy from my life? And then to then ask the question, does that then parry on to, does that then kind of carry over to everyone else in life? Do you believe that envy is the thing that's causing so much discomfort and unhappiness in the world? And if everyone could have less envy, they'd be better off.
Yeah. And I think envy is a product of desire. And I think I would sort of say it's the desire that I'm trying to remove, you know, the desire to constantly want to sort of get a bigger car, a bigger house, a bigger holiday, a bigger snowboard, a bigger this, a bigger that. I think that's what it is that, if you, and look, this is the best model I've got at the moment. I don't know if it's at the moment, it seems to be working, because it is then, giving me more time and more energy to do the things that are important to me. And that is to just share great stories with great people and be around people who I think are life enhancing, who give you pleasure to be around. I think going on walks, going on adventures, I think.
And I know you're heading back to the Camino Trail, and I remember asking you this when I was sitting in front of you, and I want to ask it again now just because no one else heard our conversation that we had when we were there. But I remember asking it, and I'm still not sure I got the answer that I was looking for from you. Not that I think I was looking for anything, but like, why go on it again? And I remember you answering like, you don't know why, and you don't know what's going to happen this time. You don't know if you're going to have the same life-changing kind of discoveries and things like that. And maybe you'll even go into it going looking for people to, hey, can I talk to you? Because do you want to be healed, hugged, or helped? Is the idea to go over there and to just meet as many people as you can and have those conversations and those stories? Or is it genuinely you're going to almost go the opposite way and go, I don't want to see anyone, talk to anyone, or convert. I want this to be purely about me. Like, why go back and do, for lack of a better word, the exact same trip again when it had such a profound change on you? Didn't you get the change there? Why do it again kind of idea?
First of all, when you're doing something for the first time, you're apprehensive about what's around the next corner. And I found a lot of time worrying about what is around the next corner, so that I wasn't actually enjoying, you know, the immediate environment. You know, I was worrying about, would I get a bed for the night, you know, and, you know, would my legs sort of give up and things. So I like the idea of not having that. I think that it is also a little bit, I suppose, sort of like, I want to know what it feels like to feel like that again, of feeling like I've shed everything and gone back to my feeling that all that was important was putting one foot in front of the other and just heading in that direction, and knowing that the family back home were all happy and well. Almost, you're right. Yeah, I don't want to meet anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to be on my own. But I know that organically, it will happen. If it doesn't happen, you know, I think that's fine as well.
Can I ask if wife or either one of your daughters tomorrow said, you know what, that sounds amazing, I want to come, would it be something that you go, hell no, you're not coming, you can go and do it yourself? Or is it something that you would be open to? It's like, yeah, I'd love to experience that and see what comes of it by us doing it together. Is where does your brain initially go when I ask that question?
To a controversial place. And that is that I think that couples need to be very careful about doing it. And what I mean by that is, as I said at the beginning, there's the two Caminos. There's the one which you just municipal hostels and the snoring, and they're very open. They shared bathrooms, they shared, you know, I'm not saying shared showers, but they shared shower rooms, and, you know, everybody changes and dresses in front of each other. And that's not for everybody. I think you can do it as a couple when you actually know where you're going to stay and where you are getting your bags forwarded. If you sort of feel like, you don't have to get your bags forwarded, but if you feel like they're getting too sort of heavy, because I think otherwise you can have different desires. I want to do 30 kilometers today. You only feel up to 10. You know, I feel shortchanged by sort of not doing, but you almost have to go at the pace of the sort of slowest person. So I think that's the first thing I would sort of say, to be careful. I'd love my wife to do it. I absolutely adore for my wife to do it. She's not in the paradigm. She's not in the same place. She said, no, I like to walk by the sea. You know, I always like to see the sea. And it's not about the walk. It's not about what you see. You know, it's not about the landscape. You know, that's all there. But it's about what's happening inside your head. Mm. It really is the sort of the story that's going on, for me anyway, the story that's going on inside me is the one that's important. None of the rest of it matters. And, you know, so saying, you know, I loved going into particularly the very small little churches, small little rundown churches. And I'm not a great religious person by any means, but having conversations with priests of these small little parish churches who would sort of come out and tell you the story of their churches. You know, these, you know, churches are sort of built upon foundations of old Roman buildings and so on. And so there is gorgeous, wonderful, wonderful things to see. But just for me, it was just that huge, overwhelming feeling of wondrous well-being. You know, it's sort of mindfulness of just, wow, I feel great. I feel happy. I feel, don't feel anxious. I feel just lovely. Mm.
Is there a sense of anything unfulfilled from the first time around? Like, I didn't quite get to do this the way I wanted to. I didn't get. And is there anything that you go back, I got to make sure this time I do this or achieve this or find this or see this?
I have to be careful about answering this, because I want to say, and I actually sort of intended to sort of say to you, anybody can do it. Anybody can do it. You don't have to be the fittest person. Obviously, you know, you've got to be somebody who's at least, you know, walking regularly. But there are certain points that you then should maybe not do. And those are very easy to identify by any of the sort of the guides, the maps and things. I found that first day more lovely. 19 and a half kilometers straight uphill, 6 kilometers straight down a very, very rutted track, set off too late. So getting to the top of the Pyrenees as the sun was going, having to sort of walk through very, very difficult, rutted out track under heavy trees where I couldn't see each footfall. I was in a lot of pain by the time I finished, and my knee swelled up, and it made the first week, 10 days, very difficult for me, because I was sort of nursing a bad knee and kept on sort of feeling like I needed to sort of go forward. This time around, there is a break, and you feel like you're shortchanging yourself, because the break comes 9 kilometers in up that first hill. But I am staying there. I booked it ahead, so I'm going to stay there. I'm going to get so I don't have to worry about starting off too early or too late. I can make that first sort of stop and then get up the next morning. And I've still got 10 kilometers uphill. It's straight uphill, Adam. It really is. You know, Tour de France teams go to practice there. You know, I was there, and a couple of, they must have been teams, because they were large, well-equipped units of bicycles, just, you know, that beautiful way powering up the hill sort of there. But it is, it's really hard work. So I think, you know, that's what I want to do sort of differently, I think, is to be a more, not have that first week, 10 days of nursing injuries. I then, 3 weeks in, I let myself get desperately dehydrated. There's one day where you've got, it's the longest, it's 18 and a half kilometers without, there's no stopping point, there's no water, there's no shelter, there's no anything at all. And I got dehydrated, and I was going 25, 26 kilometers that day. The last 7 kilometers, I was just throwing up the whole way. I was so bad. And so the next day I took a train on into Lyon. So I've sort of missed that sort of stage there. So there are things I want to do. I think just do it more gently. We're getting there. So say, come on, hurry up. You know, and I mustn't sort of do that. But yeah, I think.
You have less of a timeline on you this time around as well, do you?
No, I actually have more of a timeline because Rachel's got trips before and afterwards. And so what I am going to do this time is the first 2 days out of Lyon are just walking along roads, dusty roads, 2 days. The guidebooks tell you this. They're awful. And you don't have to do them. You can catch a bus or a train and get yourself. So I know I can do that. I'll go a couple of days ahead of myself. I think I've got like, I think I've got 36 days built in to do it. So I can take my time. But the other thing is of course, is that there's the Camino part two, which is the Santiago to Finisterre, route. And that is another 100 kilometers afterwards that you don't have to do, but I just think it's absolutely glorious. Ending up on the, you know, Finisterre literally is Roman for the end of the world. You know, you're just ending up in this tiny little fishing village at the end of the world and just jumping into the sea. So hopefully I'll be able to do that again.
When's it all booked in for?
22nd of September, I start.
Okay.
So I think, you know, once again, for anybody, it's just that is the numbers that start, you know, you can look and see the Santiago Compostela, the issuing of the certificates. They publish each day how many people complete the walk. And you just get a sort of sense of where the sort of the peak times sort of are, and by that time it's starting to come down a bit, and the weather is sort of milder, and you know, hopefully less sort of busy, less congested. I think there was about 15 started on our day from France, so that, you know, so you got to know them pretty well by the end of it. You know, not that you spent every day, because everybody's getting a different pace, and I would say almost all those 15 went on to Finisterre afterwards. Yeah,
sounds good. Well, I mean, I'll have to have you back post that to see if life has changed for you any more fundamentally, and whether you bring some of that back with you, whether there's some of it stays behind or whatnot. But I mean, it sounds like an interesting trip. I mean, I think my parents were those people who came in on the fancy bus ride at the end and did the last bit. I think mum and dad did, I think, about 130 kilometer section that they did. And I will presume, because I know they were in Spain at the time, that it was that end section that ends into the finish. I don't actually know what part. I just know, yeah. I remember years ago they said, oh, we're going to go do the Camino Trail. I'm like, okay, off you go. You know, enjoy it, you know, kind of thing. I didn't really ask too many more questions about it. But yeah, I think to kind of go back to, and to talk about myself, because I like talking about myself. I think that trip that I did to Everest was quite transformative. Not just because of the time spent with dad, but just I'm not a spiritual type person, but there is something about those mountains that just you feel that sense of I'm such a small speck of dust in the grand scheme of things, like these mountains, yeah. This energy, this environment, you know, everything around me. I am just such a small speck of dust, and I'm so insignificant in the grand scheme of the world and the universe kind of thing, which was quite a humbling thing. I don't see that as a negative thing whatsoever. And I can only imagine many treks around the world, whether it's Camino, whether it's Everest, whether it's the Annapurna Trail. Like, there's so many of them around there that I think I've always said everyone should run a marathon in their life, because you find out it's got, as you said, it's got nothing to do with the actual physicality of running a marathon. Like, you do truly go through these breakdown moments in every marathon, and you find out who you are. And I think these treks are ways of kind of hacking that you don't have to go and run a marathon as well, that you can go and do some of these treks and find out who you are. So if this conversation has helped people maybe think about doing that, or be that Camino or something else, then I think that's a positive thing.
Well, you know, I've written my little book as well, which I've got to sort of send you on my experiences as well. So I'll send that to you. But I wonder whether or not we should actually make the next podcast and open up a tin of tomatoes and fathers and relationships. And, you know, that's the way, you know, how you feel about your father and how it reflects upon the father you're being now. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that one.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate your time as always, mate. And I mean, you know, I wish you well on that journey to come, and the journey we'll continue to have ourselves as friends. And I almost call you a family member these days, because you've been involved in my life so much. But I appreciate that, and I appreciate your time today. And thanks for sharing your first level, maybe not the basement level, with us, but maybe we do open up that next door next time.
We're going to do two more podcasts and quick sessions, so I can at least catch up with your other best friend.
Absolutely. But as always, I've got to ask you the random question that came from the guest, and then I need to ask a question of next week's guest for me. It's a little thing I'm running now. So it'd be interesting, because it's kind of along the trails of what we've been talking about. But if you had to move out of the country tomorrow, if you were told you need to leave, you can't stay here anymore, where would you pick and why? If you had to go and live somewhere and you knew it's not a holiday that you're going on, it's like, okay, you have to be here for an extended period of time, where would you go to and why?
I'd go to Spain on the Camino, and I would start up a hostel on the Camino. I think it'd be lovely to...
Just hold one sec. Sorry, your earphones are... not hearing you very well.
Yeah. You there?
Yep.
Yep, we just my earbuds have gone flat.
There you go.
I would go to Spain and open up a hostel on the Camino. I think it'd be incredible to sort of have people coming through each day, hearing their stories, sharing stories, being able to, the biggest issue people face during the walk is actually blisters. The number one reason why people give up is because they get blisters. And, I'd love to sort of, I think that's where I'd want to be. And, you know, I can just shut up shop every now and then and just go and do my own bit of walking.
Sounds like a good place to be.
Yeah.
Patrick, now ask me the question for next week's guest, and I will leave you be for there.
If we were to leave future generations with a legacy of our surviving the pandemic, what would it be?
If we were to leave future generations...
Yeah, something as a legacy.
Hang on, sorry. Something as a legacy...
of us having survived the pandemic.
Survived the pandemic.
What would it be? Would it be a global, national park? You know, would it be a global endowment that every country put $1 trillion into to do something? Would it be, eradicating homelessness? You know, what should we do?
Well, next week's guest is an interesting, and like, I'm interested to see how he answers that question. I don't actually know this person. I reached out to them and asked them on the podcast. So the topic that we are talking about it will be interesting how that question is answered. So I look forward to asking that question.
All right, good.
Patrick, thank you as always, mate. As I said, I always appreciate your time, and thank you for sharing your words of wisdom with the audience again today.
And when are you going to come and walk the Camino with me?
Oh, so you do want someone. Look, I think that would be a lovely trail. And I kind of go on the back end of something. And obviously, people know this story that we actually didn't get to base camp, Dad and I, because of what happened on the very last night before we were meant to ascend there. And I've been asked the question. I've asked the question of myself, and you know, I've asked Dad the question, like, are you going to go back, and are you going to go do it again? And it's interesting because if Dad rang me up tomorrow and said, let's go and do it, let's go and finish this, you know, story that we had, I don't know whether I'd go again, purely just because what brings me most joy in my life now is spending time with my girls. And even a day away from them, I'm turning into a blubbery mess. I'm like, I just want my girls to get, you know, kind of thing. And so the thought of spending 30 days to go and trek up Mount Everest again just doesn't interest me, even though it's with my father that I'm becoming more and more aware of with regards to my mother as well, that they're getting older. They're not going to be here forever. And you know, I got to try and spend as much time with them as I can, because I know that if I play this comment back in 30 years' time and they're passed away, I'll go, you're an idiot. You should have spent more time with them. They're now not here, kind of thing. I know I'll have that kind of conversation with myself anyway. But I say all of that to say that what I actually want to do to go and finish that in quote with my father is I'd love to take my girls up there in a future time with my father's ashes and take him up there in quote in that kind of form and go and get to do that with my girls, go and still finish the journey and have us all there in kind of a spiritual way and a physical way. That's kind of where my head goes to the story ending in a fairy tale type way. So I'm hoping I can convince my girls that they want to go and walk Everest with their dad for 30 days. At the moment, I reckon I could convince them because they want to be in my life, but maybe when they're 17-year-olds or they're 24-year-olds, they're like, I don't want to spend 30 days with you, old man. Piss off. So I don't know. I'll have to wait and see. But that then comes back full story to answer your question. Unless I'm bringing my girls, the idea of, not that I don't think 30 days with you would be a very enjoyable time, because I honestly believe it would be, but spending 30 days away from my girls is just an impossibility type thought at the moment. So it's, unless they're coming with me to do the Camino, it's probably not something I'm doing in the very near future.
No, well, that's what I say. It's either the young or the older that do the Camino. So, yeah, that's why. That's why.
Wait and see. Right. But, Patrick, thank you so much, mate. I'll churn out. But, yeah, to everyone listening in, I hope you've enjoyed our chat as always. I'll talk to you next week. I love you. Bye.